So good morning.
Good morning.
Today is July 24th, 2015, and we are here with Professor Claire Young, who is going to tell us about her life in general and her time here at UBC. So great to have you.
Thank you.
So let's start from the very beginning. Tell us about your background, your childhood, where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in Londonderry, Northern Ireland. Went to school there and lived there until I was about 14. And then my folks moved to England, and I moved to England with them. And I went to university in England, and we can chat about that in a second. But and eventually I came to Canada when I was just 21. I had finished my law degree, and that was 1970. And I came to Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, which I loved, but that's another story.
Okay. So tell us about the university over
there. Okay, so I in England, you don't do any pre-law. So I actually was the first person in my immediate family to go to university. And I went to the London School of Economics and did my law degree there, although I think quite interestingly, I had no intention of doing law. I wanted to do political science. But when I applied, they didn't have any space in political science, so they said, go to the law department for a couple of weeks. We didn't call it law school in those days. And after a couple of weeks, someone will drop out of political science, and you can move into back into poli-sci. Mm-hmm. But I started out in law, and I just was captured or captivated by the people I was working with, the subject, and so on. So I actually stayed in the law department. I did my three-year LLB, as I say, at the London School of Economics and Political Science.
Great.
In London.
So what were some of your first impressions of law school?
Well, you know, and again, you call it law school, and that's the first thing I think is quite interesting, because in the UK, your first degree, it could be political science, law, sociology, economics, medicine, whatever. And so we never thought of it as a school. It was just a department within the university. And there was a benefit to that, which was that it was very interdisciplinary. In my degree, I had to take courses such as economics, political science, sociology. I think I had to take a stats course. Mm-hmm. And that was the idea was that then, as well as the law courses, you would be in a position then to article with a firm of solicitors or go to the bar. We had a bifurcated profession in the UK. So I was in classes with people who were doing law as their main degree, but also people who weren't, and so people from other disciplines. And that was tremendous, because I've been a huge fan of interdisciplinarity. I think it shows in my academic work over the years. That was the basis of how I came to be so keen on interdisciplinarity and the importance of bringing to bear a very contextual approach to a legal analysis. But I loved it from day one. It was the late 60s, the Vietnam War was on, LSE was a hotbed of revolution, the university was closed down for 6 weeks because we were all so naughty and badly behaved and out on demonstrations and all of that kind of stuff. LSE is pretty unusual. It, at that time, had 3,500 students, of whom 1,000 were grad students, and probably 800 of those 1,000 were American grad students. And a lot of them had come over to do their studies at LSE and therefore avoid the draft and so on. So there's a lot of political activity around, particularly the Vietnam War, but also around issues such as economic inequality and so on. And it was just the most vibrant place to be.
Oh, nice. So what was your curriculum like? What kind of courses did you take?
Not too different from what you see today. First year program was pretty similar. I do recall legal history was mandatory in first year, and I thought that was, I think that was actually good. I enjoyed that. But the basics, contracts, torts, property, what we called public law, because obviously no written constitution in the UK. In the upper years, we had some choice, but there was one course that you had to take, and you had to take it in third year. It was the only mandatory course. It was a course I hated at the time, found incredibly difficult, but looking back, believed was the most important course I ever took, and that was jurisprudence. Mm-hmm. And it was pure legal theory, and, you know, I just, like, oh, so difficult. It seemed so obscure and abstract, and it didn't seem to have any meaning or purpose. And yet, when I finally got into academia, and even in the practice, actually, of law, which I did for quite a few years, I always looked back and thought that the skills I learnt in that legal theory jurisprudential course were some of the most important skills that I ever learnt in law school.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's interesting is that I actually specialised in tax law, and that's been my academic career. I never took a tax law course in my LLB. And I would open up my Tax 1 course with students here and say, well, you know, because I never took tax, you know, what are you doing taking tax? Well, it's the most ridiculous subject to take. It's quite difficult, you know. I never took it in law school. And they would look at me like, oh my word, how do I get out of this course? Does she know anything? But it was always fun. So my point, I think, is, and it has been to law students, has always been, don't fret too much about the subjects you take. You just never know where your career will take you.
Great. So what happened after you graduated?
I got my degree. What happened was, these, of course, were the days when jobs were there for us all. I'm a baby boomer. Like, I was born in 1949. They opened universities for me. They built schools for me, hospitals, not me personally, but for my generation. So I had worked in the summer for a firm of solicitors, and I was eventually going to article with them and so on in London. But these were the days when you sort of did your gap year after university. We didn't call it that then. And so I actually used to be a semi-professional tennis player as well. And I saw an ad for a job as a tennis professional at a tennis club in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. And the next day, I saw an ad for a teaching assistant in the law school in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. So, put the two together, got the job as a teaching assistant. I was just 21, I just had my 21st birthday. Had the job for the summer as the tennis pro, and I played some professional tennis tournaments in northern US and southern Canada and so on as well to make a bit of money. And so I came to Canada with $50 in my pocket, and the jobs lined up, and took it from there.
So this was in 1970?
1970.
Okay. So how did we get from... from 1917 to UBC?
Oh, well, that's I could go on forever. But, I mean, essentially, okay, so I started out in 1970. I was teaching legal research and writing at the University of Saskatchewan. Loved it. Actually, there were some very well-known academic scholars there who have become extremely well-known since over the years. People such as, and I particularly mention John McLaren, who became dean at Windsor and the University of Victoria and so on and so forth. And I taught with him in the LRW program. And then I played tennis and ran the pro shop and gave lessons in the summer. But what happened was, after about a year and a half, maybe 2 years, I finally scraped up enough money to go back to England. And I went back for 3 months to see family, friends. And when I got back there, I just thought, ah, gosh, you know, I've had such a brilliant time with the last couple of years in Canada. I've got so many good friends there. And I never consciously made a decision that I am never going to go back to England to work, but I decided I would return to Canada and article with a law firm and get my professional qualifications. And, you know, as I say, it was never this big decision, I am now going to live in Canada forevermore. It was more that it just felt like I wanted to continue with the life I had started to build for myself. I should say, when I first started teaching at the U of S, I was younger than 90% of the students. I was younger than most of the students I was teaching, because we don't do pre-law in England, as I mentioned. So anyway, I articled with a law firm in Saskatoon, and just a small firm, did criminal defence, bit of family law, that kind of thing. But then I applied for a job with the Institute of Law Research and Reform in Alberta, which is was the Law Reform Commission, so I worked there for a few years. But then I got into working in the government sphere, the provincial government. I started in Regina. I worked there as the chief legislative counsel, so I was drafting legislation.
Mm-hmm.
Loved it, had a great time, did that for quite a few years, was recruited to move back to Alberta to become the assistant chief legislative counsel in a much larger law office, and eventually actually ended up as an assistant deputy minister in the Alberta government. did that for about 8 years, loved every minute of it. But then what happened was, very serendipitous, I was asked to draft the Alberta Corporate Income Tax Act. Alberta had decided to develop its own corporate tax system, because this was the era of emerging energy companies and so on and so forth. And I was asked to draft that piece of legislation, and to do it I had a team which included two tax practitioners, three or four people from the Treasury Department in Alberta, myself, and a more junior colleague in my office. We spent 2 years on that project, and it was amazing. I had never taken a tax course. I knew nothing about tax. I was a pretty damn good draftsperson. I knew how to do that. And I learned so much, and I just got so interested that I thought, okay, I'd love to go back to school, do some graduate work, and do it in the tax field. And at that time, Alberta had a program. You could basically take a sabbatical and be paid 60% of your salary for 1 year to pursue graduate studies. So I leapt at the chance, and I came out to UBC, and I worked with someone who's well known to many people here, a fellow called Michael O'Keefe, who was a practitioner but was an adjunct faculty member. So he was my supervisor, so I came out. I had only 1 year. Nothing like that. Nothing could be a greater incentive to get your thesis written. So I worked with Mike, had a brilliant time, took some tax courses, was a student obviously at UBC, finished, graduated, got my LLM, went back to Alberta, and the deal was, because they had paid me 60% of my salary, I had to work for a certain period of time, and that period of time was just under 2 years. And just under 2 years later, I saw an ad for a job at the University of Western Ontario, or Western University as it's now called, mm-hmm. And it was in the tax field. And so I remember being interviewed for it, and this is a bit of an in-joke, not hearing anything for a couple of weeks and being quite concerned, because in the milieu I worked in, you applied for a job and you heard the next day whether you got it or not. Of course, in the university arena, as we all know, it takes months sometimes for these decisions to get made. Anyway, about 2 weeks later, I had a call from the dean at Western offering me the job. So I, and I just do have to say, I remember distinctly what I was earning in Alberta, and I went to work at Western for just slightly over half that salary. But I was really keen to do it, and I just had a great time at Western. We had the National Tax Center there. I worked with a fellow called Brian Arnold, who was a senior tax scholar, and we had half a dozen of us in the tax area. I learned so much. I had a great time teaching, picked up a couple of teaching awards, got my research agenda up and running. Everything was going absolutely superbly. Planned to sort of stay there. Did actually, was there for 8 years. But then I met my partner, and so we were then in the position of trying to get jobs in the same place. Mm-hmm. And that in and of itself, if I'll just continue unless you want to stop me, but that in and of itself is another story, because my partner was and is still Susan Boyd, mm-hmm. who has been the chair in Feminist Legal Studies for many years here at UBC. So we got involved. We decided we were going to stay together. And she was teaching at Carleton University in Ontario, Ottawa, and I was obviously at Western. And again, the historical context here is people who were at UBC. One day, very quickly into our relationship, maybe a week or so after we first got together, we weren't even living together permanently, Joel Backham from UBC phoned Susan and said, we're setting up this new endowed chair in Feminist Civil Studies. Marley, that is the late Marley Klein, Joel's partner, and a professor here at UBC, who tragically died in her very early 40s. So Marley and Joel kept bugging Susan to apply for the job. Susan wanted to stay at Carleton. She loved it because it wasn't a law school, it was a law department. So traces of the kind of thing I'd enjoyed at LSE. Mm-hmm. Well, not everybody who graduated went on to practice law at all. In fact, they couldn't at Carleton. They had to get a law degree to do that, but it was a legal studies department. She didn't really want to go to law school, but Joel and Marley talked her into applying. She applied, she got the interview, and as she would say, and she can tell you her story, she was so relaxed during that interview because she didn't really want the job that she got the offer. And Lynn Smith was the dean at the time. Meanwhile, I was supposed to leave that year for Australia to take up a named a chair in international tax law for a year. And Susan had a leave from her university to come with me. So that was the one option. The other option was if she got the job at UBC, what do we do? So she received the job offer. And Lynn Smith was the dean, and Lynn Smith was a very astute, smart, wonderful dean, and she was very flexible and said to Susan, okay, we have no other permanent positions, so Claire, you know, there's no position to give her, but why don't you come for a year, and we'll pay for you to move out, see if you like it. If you like it, then you can stay on, subject to the terms we've agreed. If you don't, you can go back, we'll pay your way back. Meanwhile, just before term began, a colleague here took a leave, so I was given I think two-thirds appointment for 1 year teaching legal institutions, two sections of it, which was a core first-year course, had nothing to do with tax. So we came out for the year, and I get to say, I think it's fair to say, so we came out for the year. Quite quickly, by November, there was a job offer to me. The faculty had obviously decided it was worth hiring me, and they needed somebody in tax, and a fellow called Dennis Pavlich on this faculty worked with Lynn Smith. And the university, at that time, had a program to allow deans to recruit senior women into the ranks, and so there was some kind of bridging money against a future retirement. I was a senior woman. I was an associate professor at the time. And I think that was a fantastic plan. That was the first thing. The second thing was the university had a spousal hiring plan, which I've always been a critic of because it's quite ineffective if the spouses are in different faculties. Because one person gets the offer, that means the other dean has to then give up a position to hire the spouse, and they're reluctant to do it. It's a lot easier when the two spouses are in the same faculty because it's obviously the same dean. So, and the second, I think, important historical context here is we were being hired as a lesbian couple. Mm-hmm. And to my knowledge, we were the first same-sex couple hired at UBC under the spousal hiring plan, such as it was then. And this was in 1993, July 1st, we were hired. And this was the beginning, I think, of universities and public entities giving benefits to spouses, regardless of the sex, so same-sex, opposite-sex spouses, benefited to the same extent. So dental, medical, and so on and so forth. And so that was very exciting. And we came to UBC, when we came, I recall one of our colleagues, Doug Saunders, who's definitely someone you might want to talk to, saying, this is the gayest law school in Canada. And Susan and I were just thinking, oh my word, this what's he on about? In fact, UBC at that time probably had at least half a dozen, if not more, gay men on faculty. We had been hired as an out lesbian couple. And that was, you know, that was a fantastic time. That was really, it felt very progressive. It felt enabling for students. The students, I think, really responded well, the gay and lesbian students. First day I was here officially, I just recall various, couple of gay male students, a couple of lesbian students coming by, saying how important it was to have out faculty members. Not all the gay men on faculty were out at that time. So that was the context of our hiring.
So this was in 1993?
Yeah, we came out July 1st, 92 for the year. I got the offer in November. We then dithered, and poor Lynn, poor Dean Smith, because Susan didn't wasn't sure she wanted to stay. Mm-hmm. I, on the other hand, of course, was saying, oh, I would love to stay because I loved Vancouver. I'd been a grad student here. I thought the faculty here was on the cusp of becoming something really great. I felt people were doing the kind of work that I liked. There was an opportunity for interdisciplinarity. There was an opportunity for cross-disciplinary work. There were some excellent socio-legal scholars on faculty, quite a few of them. And that was really where my work was focused. So it was a perfect fit for me. I think, and you can talk to Susan, it became a very good fit for her. But we did dither for a bit, and finally we said yes, we would stay.
Great. So what was different between UBC Law then, in 1983, and now, or when you retired?
Yeah, that's a tough question, because there are pluses and negatives.
Let's hear them all.
Okay. I think it's fair to say, and I'm speaking very personally here, when we came to UBC, we had some brilliant socio-legal scholars here doing cutting-edge work. And I think, but there was always a tension at UBC between those who, and I'm not being critical of them in any way, but who would say that the kind of work that the socio-legal scholars were doing was not real law. That it was, and for me to say that their work was more doctrinally focused is not meant to be a critique of that work. It's just it was very different. And obviously there's doctrinal work in the stuff I was doing and my research, but there developed a bit of a tension about where UBC was going to go, the law school, because, you know, there are finite resources in terms of hirings and money and, at that time, of course, space in the old building. And so for a while, I think we had an acceptable sort of happy medium of laissez-faire. People did what they wanted to do. They were polite. They did not overtly criticize people doing work they didn't think was particularly appropriate or whatever. And so I think that for the students, though, I do think at that time there was some tension around the sort of more lefty faculty and, quote, other faculty in terms of the students' perception. And of course, for many students who come to law school, they believe that there is such a thing as the real law, the rules that they must learn. And of course, law is rule-based. But as I've always said in my tax class, you can recite the Income Tax Act till the cows come home, but unless you understand the context it operates in, and its historical, political, and economic background, you will never understand how the rules work. Like the most technical of rules, they change. The rules change constantly. So you need a much more theoretical understanding of tax policy, tax law, and so on. And that, for students, is always a tricky one, because they take the view often that it should be the rules that they're talked about. So in terms of the law school then, I think it was struggling to determine really what its focus was. I think at the same time, my view is we were operating under less than optimal conditions, to put it mildly, in terms of the physical plot. I mean, the building was just a nightmare, and it was not conducive to collegiality. It was not conducive to students feeling good about themselves or good about the law school. It was a dump. And, you know, a dump makes people think they're in a dump. So the changes since then, of course, the building is absolutely number one. I think it, at the same time, has allowed everybody associated with the law school to feel much more professional, much more happy about their milieu and their, so where they are and what UBC law is. I also think for a while, we stagnated in terms of new faculty. We didn't have positions. We couldn't hire new people. We got very top-heavy with senior associate professors and full professors, you know, in there. And I was one of this group, probably, in there, you know, by then, late 50s, early 60s, not bringing enough new people in. over the last few years, the second major change has been the infusion of new faculty, and I say new young faculty, and I shouldn't really do it by age because I'm not. I'm just saying these people, brilliant scholars coming in with their PhDs, pretty much de rigueur now to have one, and regardless of what area they work in, regardless of whether I particularly thought we should hire that individual or not, they have been phenomenal for the law school. They have just infused the place with more energy. I think that they are the future of the place, which is one reason I was really actually happy to retire. So the fiscal plant, I think Marianne as dean just has made such a difference in terms of resources for this place. Obviously, Peter Allen's donations to the building and, of course, now the naming of the law school are just phenomenal. I think this has put UBC absolutely tippy-top in terms of Canadian law schools, and I'm hoping that my colleagues, and I think they will, that everybody's up to the challenge on that position now.
Great. So what was the workload like when you started teaching, and how that changed?
It hasn't changed that much. I mean, the workload was, the assumption was you would teach four courses. I at the beginning I did teach in the first year, I taught legal institutions, but after that, because there were so few tax scholars here, there was just myself, Joost Blom taught a tax course, and that for quite a while was it actually. I taught nothing but tax courses, but I still taught four courses, and the theory was you taught three core courses and one seminar. And the seminar would be in your area of research expertise. I don't think that's changed much. I think it's similar. I think what has changed, and which is excellent, is we are giving more course releases now to people at certain times in their career. This didn't happen in my day, but I think it's a phenomenal improvement. New faculty who come in and don't have significant teaching experience will get a course release in their first year. They'll get another course release to take pre-tenure. That is so good. I think it's fantastic. We didn't have that. It was just straight four courses. Mm. It was always difficult balancing the writing with the teaching. But again, I think a change there. I think the expectations have gone up year after year. I think in my day, it was easier to get tenure. It was easier to get promoted to be a full professor or associate. In terms of your scholarship, you did not have to have such a significant body of work that you do now. I actually like the fact that the expectation is higher because I think the research and the writing is such a key part of what we do. It absolutely informs our teaching, and so that is something else I think is a positive. But generally speaking, again, administratively, the idea was you might chair one committee and sit on a couple of others. I gather now the new dean, which I'm a big fan of as well, is reducing that expectation. So that's good. If you can reduce the administrative load, give people more space for their research and writing, that's a plus.
Great. So what are changes in the profession you have noticed throughout your career?
Number one, far more women. Just a huge change. It's funny because when I was at my law school at LSE, we were a class of 55 and we had 25 women, and that was 1970. Now that is partly because, as I've said, it was you got an LLB, or you could be in the class and not actually be pursuing the LLB. You might be getting a BA or whatever in a different subject like economics. So that sort of is, I think, why there were more women. But I think the biggest change has been more women in the profession. Sadly, I think we still see, there is still no question, a glass ceiling. And it's not as overt as saying women are not being made partner because they're women. It's simply that so many women are leaving the profession. They're just leaving it in droves. And they leave it for all kinds of reasons, to have kids or so on and so forth, or just because, as I used to say to my students, if you are in the private practice of law, it is a business. It is about making money. And your value to your firm is essentially the clients you bring in and the income you generate. And I think there are many men for whom that is extremely difficult, troubling, and so on, men who want to stay at home and you know, or men who want to spend more time with kids and so on and so forth. But there's no question that the impact of that is gendered, and we're seeing fewer women, not fewer than before, but we are seeing proportionately, for the women we graduate, there should be far more women in senior levels with law firms. There should be far more women practicing law. The second difference in terms of law, which I think is very sad, is the demise of legal aid and the consequent increase of self-represented clients. And I know that, for example, Beverly McLaughlin, the Chief Justice, and others have spoken about this at length, but if I think about the practice of law generally, and I think about sort of representation of clients, I do think that the end of, I think it was almost the end of legal aid has meant, particularly in areas like family law, and I see it in tax law too, cases before the tax court, an increase in self-represented litigants, and that's a shame. I think there's a role for the state to play in supporting those who do not have the economic means to participate in legal action. Mm-hmm.
So let's go back to the law school for a second. Can you describe any notable colleagues you have had?
Well, there's so many of them, you know, and I always think first of the deans. I think Lynn Smith, who was the first woman dean at UBC, she was on faculty at the time. She, I think, did it in a very quiet, understated way, an extraordinary job of trying to move us forward. She was the one who raised the $1 million, which in those days, you know, was a huge amount of money for the chair in pharmaceutical studies. She was involved in the chair in legal history. She made, I think, some really good hires, obviously not talking about myself. So I think she was really an important historical player. I think Marianne as well, Marianne Babinski, very unusual profile. For UBC to hire someone, nobody had any idea who she was, from the US, Houston. So for an American, first of all, to come into a Canadian law school as dean, highly unusual. For UBC, which I think has always liked hiring its own. I mean, Joost Blom was the dean before that, and I'm not going to sort of comment much on his deanship, but he was internal as Lynn had been. I don't think there'd ever been an external dean before, other than perhaps Ken Lissick, who was not really external. Others could comment on that. So Marianne came in, and I actually served as her associate dean and latterly senior associate dean for the first 7 years of her deanship, maybe 8 years actually, some inordinately long time, far too long in my humble opinion. And I think she, my word, she just brought this sort of very professional approach. She had a sense of what legal education should be like. She thought we were under-resourced. She thought, I think you might say, that the review of UBC law that she was given was done by external reviewers prior to accepting the appointment, I think it used the word dysfunctional for our law school. And that was ranging from the building and the impact it was having and everything else. She, over her 12 years, has completely transformed the place and made it a very professional, a place that people could be proud to be and proud to work. And as I say, she's hired some amazing people. In terms of non-dean colleagues, it's always interesting. I mean, there have been some. I think of Bill Black, who out gay man hired way probably in the 70s, actually. Specialized in human rights and so on. Wonderful colleague, very understated, but did outstanding work, particularly in terms of litigation, and was involved in a lot of key litigation that emerged over the years. Bertie McLean. I think it was a privilege to know him. He was one of the very early hires here. Curious I said that, but he certainly seemed quite old when I was hired. But again, you couldn't find a more interesting, smart, intellectual colleague. Very happy to share whatever knowledge he had with other faculty, including myself, when I first came. So he springs to mind. And then, I mean, there's, you know, my colleagues have been, you know, we're all very different. The thing about law professors is we are all used to standing at the front of a classroom and being listened to. And that gives us all, I think, if not big egos, certainly a sense of, we know what we're talking about, don't you mess with me. And as I say, we're used to being the ones that people listen to. And so when we get together with each other, I think, you know, there are always a few tensions around that. But.
And what about any memorable students or lawyers you have encountered?
Oh, there's so many. And I wouldn't even know where to start. But certainly for me, I always think of the students that I got to know best. So I think of Kim Brooks, who was a student of mine. And I have a little joke, which is, you know you're old when your ex-student and ex-research assistant and current friend becomes a dean. so Kim worked with me as a research assistant. She's the only student I ever had at the end of first year. She hadn't actually taken a tax course. I have no idea what I was thinking. But somehow she managed to talk me into hiring her. Best thing I ever did. And of course, she's gone on to be a huge success story. As I say, currently dean at the Schulich School in Dal. And she's young, I mean, just in her 40s, probably early 40s. So she's one. I think of other students. Again, I think of students I got to know well. Katrina Pacey, more recently, who, you know, put her money where her mouth is, who always said that she cared a lot about social injustice, that she was doing law to make a difference. And she has done that. She's been involved in a lot of high-profile litigation, doing it through Pivot Legal, so she's not in it for the money. She's someone who stands out. But there's so many. I mean, I couldn't even begin to think of them all, and I'm terrible at names, because I'm the kind of person, if I walk down Bay Street in Toronto and somebody says, oh, Professor Young, gosh, I remember, you know, blah, 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 and I look at them and say, oh, you know, how's it going? How, you know, how's articles or whatever? And their face falls and they say, I graduated 10 years ago. I'm a partner now. Oops. So always difficult to do that. But there are so many students that have come out of here and done just most remarkable things, mm-hmm. including, for example, Catherine de Bern. There you go, there's one. Now Dean of UBC Law. Was a student when I first started here, was the first part-time student to win the gold medal.
So are there any individuals you would recommend for us to interview to tell
us
more
I
about the history?
I think Doug Saunders. I don't know if you've, and you know, Doug is, he's currently living in Thailand. he was somebody, he taught the first sexuality course here, I think, and always was, you know, incredibly supportive of gay and lesbian students way back when most of them were totally clustered. And so I think he would be interesting. Bernie McLean is another one, of course, just because his institutional knowledge is profound. I'd like you to talk to Joel Bakken, because Joel is somebody who was very instrumental in the fact Susan and I came here, and he is what you would describe as now a public intellectual. He's written, you know, a best-selling book on called The Corporation and so on and so forth. But he also has a very interesting take on the evolution of UBC law from where it was to what it is now.
Great. So, as you know, we are recording this for posterity, and now you have to share a few anecdotes with us about the law school. Anything funny that comes to mind?
Oh, my word.
Anything you remember fondly?
Well, there's all kinds of things, but I can't... I would say... there's always things. I think my term as associate dean had some humorous moments, and here I go back to the old building. And so I recall vividly chasing squirrels. Like, you know, somebody would say, oh, there's a squirrel in the building, and for some reason it would land on my desk, so I'd be out there with a bucket trying to catch a damn squirrel or chase it out. I also remember, and again, this perhaps is not the most tasteful of stories, but every year the engineering students go on some terrible drinking binge or whatever around Christmas time, and I recall being in my office and having three different colleagues phone me and say, Claire, there's a drunk engineer puking in the bushes outside the law school. What are you going to do? Or something. What am I supposed to do?
And what did you do?
I phoned security and they came and took them all away. So I think the other thing that I would say, and again, it comes from my time as associate dean, and I think it's important, and we haven't touched on this, I think the pressures on students today are far greater than they were when I was a student or even when I started teaching. As we know, tuition fees have gone way up. Our students are working more and more outside the law school, right? They've got 2-3 jobs. So when I was associate dean, the thing that struck me was we have had, and we do have, some amazing students who, in the face of the greatest difficulty, whether that be health issues, economic issues, or disasters that occur within their family or whatever, just get stuck in and continue on, do the best they can, and graduate and make me proud. And I think you can't, I mean, every student that goes through the law school will have their own personal tale, but increasingly it is becoming more and more difficult for them. They're leaving with huge debt. They're stressed out about it. They're worried about it. The competitiveness to get into law school in the first place is so phenomenal. That leads to what I call the imposter syndrome, where students, and certainly when I was associate dean, would be in my office saying, oh, I don't belong here, I really don't. You know, I didn't get my offer until July, and everybody else is so much smarter. And what gave me pleasure was being able to say to them, hey, I was the last person to get into my law school, because I was, actually. I didn't get admitted until just the day before term began. And so I think we can't underestimate the pressure students are under, and they're the real, I think, unsung heroes and heroines of the law school story.
Mm-hmm. So you retired last year.
I did.
Any more advice for potential students at this point?
I try not to give students advice, because I'm now probably out of touch. And what I would say, though, is, and I feel strongly about this, I chose to retire because I felt I was 65, and I'd always had that in my mind. I didn't retire because I was disillusioned, burned out, or fed up. I retired because, though, I felt it was getting past my sell-by date. And by that I mean I felt that I had just given it my all over the years, enjoyed every minute of it, but it was time to move on, free up some space for new colleagues to get into the enterprise. And I have zero regrets about that. It's the best thing I ever did, I think. And I would encourage some of my more senior colleagues to do the same, actually. And I think the fear of retiring and then what does one do, there are so many things that one can do. And it's a hackneyed phrase, but I don't know how I found the time to work is what I feel like saying now. So I just think it's important for people, you know, from the age of 60 on, who are currently here, to think about their future and whether really they should continue here or have they got other things they could do, and then let some of the youngsters come in and enjoy it as much as we all did when we were youngsters. Because, of course, many of the people here came in on that wave in the early 70s. And this is the group who now should be retiring or is retiring. People like Robin Elliott, myself, Susan Boyd, I think Yos Blom is retiring soon, and so on.
So what is next for you?
What's next is continuing to do what I do, which is I've kept up. I've always done some work in the international field, in the tax arena. I run training programs for tax policy analysts, particularly in Southeast Asia. And I love doing that, and I'm teaching them tax theory. So that is right up my street, so I'll do a bit of that. I am lending my expertise, such as it is, to some NGOs, some more socially progressive organizations that have taken on particular challenges that might involve in some way the tax system, so I'm doing that. I am doing 8 million other things that I thoroughly enjoy, splitting my time between Vancouver and Nova Scotia.
Well, on that positive note, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to hear your story.
Thanks, Alex. Enjoyed it.
And wish you all the best.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.